Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. Back in the late 90s, Canadian researcher Timothy Caulfield became interested in social media and how health information was being presented there. Anything from diet and exercise tips to vitamins or vaccines. Social media was in its infancy then. Think Six Degrees and then later Friendster or MySpace. Tim's a professor of health law and policy, and some of his colleagues were baffled by his new interest. Like, why do you think this is important?
It was viewed by academia, I think, as a little bit of a side thing. It wasn't really viewed as a central issue. Holy cow. Has that changed?
Billions of people worldwide are now using social media, and health is a major topic. Information, good or bad, spreads at lightning speed. You can find communities that confirm what you already believe, and we have celebrities who kind of feel like our friends offering us advice and products.
This isn't Grace Kelly in the pages of Life magazine, right? It's Kim Kardashian in her bathroom on your phone telling you to use this product, right?
And we're bombarded with potentially harmful information. Cures that could kill, anti-vaccine campaigns.
It just adds to the chaotic information environment. It becomes more difficult to tease out what's nonsense and what's sense. And I think that problem is one of the most significant.
Like Tim, many scientists now view false information on social media as a public health threat, and fighting back has become a science of its own.
There is a belief that debunking or trying to counter misinformation will backfire, or that you are going to amplify the conspiracy theory or the myth or the bit of misinformation. In fact, the body of evidence doesn't support that concern.
But Tim says, if you want to win, you have to do it right.
I think what we need to do is we need trusted voices on social media. We need to populate social media with good science. We need to do it in a way that is shareable and interesting. We need to use creative communication strategies, you know, maybe humor, but also narratives, right, to get across the good science. And the evidence tells us if you do it well, you can move the needle. But It's tough. You know, it's tough.
On today's episode, social media and our health. Bad info on Facebook, conspiracy theories on Twitter, doctors on TikTok, and mining social media posts to check on people's mental health. First up, the coronavirus pandemic has led to an incredible amount of wrong information on social media. I mean, who didn't have a Facebook friend who shared that plandemic YouTube video a few weeks ago? If you somehow escaped it, it was a documentary-style conspiracy video that went viral but then was taken down. Some health experts say we are facing an infodemic with so many wild fabrications. The coronavirus was created by Bill Gates, or it's spread by 5G radio waves. It can be cured by drinking bleach. But this has also given researchers an opportunity to learn more about how misinformation is spread on social media. Liz Tung has more.
Fake news is nothing new, but arguably, we have never seen the high-speed spread of misinformation like this. So my first question for researchers is, why? What is it about the coronavirus that seems to have tripped this giant worldwide game of telephone? According to Kate Starbird, co-founder of the Center for an Informed Public at the University of Washington, it's not as unusual as you might think.
So rumors are actually like a typical part of a crisis event. It's natural human behavior. You know, something's happened, you're not sure what's happened. Early on in the event, you don't have perfect information.
Let's say, for example, you've just been in an earthquake. You felt the ground shaking, heard the sirens, but you don't know a lot of the big stuff yet. How much damage there was, what roads are blocked, where you can go for help. So you go to see your neighbor, and the two of you start talking.
So you're trying to figure these things out, and then actually you feel anxiety because you might have to take certain actions based on what's happened, and you need information. And under those conditions, what we do as humans is we try to resolve that uncertainty and that anxiety. We try to find that information, and we try to find people and talk to people and share information and come up with explanations. And those explanations, we talk about it as collective sense making.
And now, and for the last few months, the entire world has been collective sense making together online, which is kind of a big deal. Because if you think about it, this is really the first global disaster we've experienced since the rise of social media. That means rumors can fly from one corner of the earth to the other in a matter of seconds.
It's truly global.
That's Kathleen Carley. She's a professor of computer science at Carnegie Mellon, where she also runs the Center for Informed Democracy and Social Cybersecurity.
So that means people around the globe are spreading disinformation, and it will get picked up by people in other countries.
Usually, disaster-related rumors start dying away once you get some answers. But that hasn't been the case with the coronavirus. Uncertainty about how the virus works, where it came from, what governments are doing about it, a lot of that's still up in the air. The result? Rumors. And these germs of misinformation are spreading just as fast, if not faster, than an actual virus. The problem is we can't exactly social distance on social media. Kate Starbird, the first expert we heard from, says we're at a moment when the world is more connected than ever, but we haven't yet developed the digital hygiene to fully protect ourselves.
It's hitting at this moment where our information systems are already sort of characterized by persistent, pervasive misinformation, disinformation, and the strategic manipulation of these online spaces. So the combination is like the natural process of trying to figure things out is, you know, we're all rumoring, we're spreading misinformation.
And even though we're all facing the same threat, we're not all coming at it from the same perspective. There can be miscommunications from one language to another, from one culture to another, and even intentional deception between groups that may not have each other's best interests at heart.
And then at the same time, we're open to this exploitation, not just from someone who's coming from a neighbor, you know, the next town over, like, which would have been a historical crisis, but people can exploit us from all parts of the world. People can be exploiting other people right now. And so it's just really this kind of perfect storm.
So the big question is, who's spreading all this misinformation and why? Kathleen says, in a general sense, it's coming from all over the world. Some rumors have been traced back to conspiracy theorists, some to so-called black news sites. Even the Chinese government and some of our own politicians have gotten in on the act. But in general, Kathleen says, the origins of rumors are really tough to find.
So two things that are extremely hard in social media. One is attribution, that is knowing exactly who started it. And the second one is knowing motivation.
Kathleen says knowing motivation is important for making a crucial distinction. Crucial, anyway, in her field of research. What counts as misinformation and what counts as disinformation?
Disinformation typically means information that is inaccurate and that is intentionally spread by those who know that it is not accurate. Whereas misinformation is inaccurate, but it is spread by those who don't know that it is inaccurate.
Like, for instance, your mom sending you a message to get cash out of the ATM because Uncle Bob's accountant says there's going to be a run on banks. That is misinformation. But someone else sharing the same information with the intention of creating financial havoc in the US, that's what we call disinformation. Like Kathleen said before, it can be almost impossible figuring out which one you're looking at sometimes. But researchers have been able to find clues by tracking the propagation patterns of individual rumors. In fact, that's what Kathleen and her team were doing when they made a startling discovery.
So a lot of the misinformation that is being spread by bots.
In fact, Kathleen and her colleagues have analyzed 200 million tweets about coronavirus, and they found that more than half of them are likely coming from bots. On top of that, 41 of the 50 most influential retweeters, also bots. What all this means is that a lot of these rumors are actually orchestrated campaigns of disinformation. So how much of that bad information is making its way to our screens? Kate Starbridge says it's different for everyone. It depends on a bunch of factors, including your search history and what you tend to click on.
There's sort of the dynamics of how we organize our lives online, both like how we choose our friend relationships and how we seek out information that aligns with our biases. And now we can find all sorts of different kinds of information that aligns with those biases. How the recommendation algorithms work sometimes to send us more of what we like to keep us coming back. There's something about our information environment right now which is highlighting old vulnerabilities and perhaps taking advantage of them in new ways.
And the results can be dangerous. Like, for instance, the people who've been setting 5G cell towers on fire after hearing they're causing coronavirus. Kathleen Carley says there's longer-term risk, too.
First, it reduces your trust in institutions. So it reduces your trust in the medical community and governments and so on. And when you get that reduction in trust, you know, chaos can come out of it.
For instance, protests against social distancing, or people who are spreading or even dying from coronavirus because they tried to treat it by eating bananas.
So it can cost money, it can cost lives, you know, and it reduces trust in your institutions.
Of course, not all rumors are dangerous or worthy of the work it takes to debunk them. One of Kathleen's favorites is
that because of social distancing, the pollution in Italy has gone down so much that the dolphins and the swans have returned to the canals of Venice.
I also thought it was true. Unfortunately, it wasn't. But it also doesn't really matter. What we need to focus on, experts say, are the rumors that are actually causing harm. Whether that harm has to do with physical health or something more abstract. For example, Kathleen and her colleagues have discovered that a lot of the bots spreading false information about COVID-19 are also sowing political division among the American public. And that could have serious consequences, including for the upcoming presidential election. But there's a kind of silver lining to the current infodemic. It's given researchers more data than they could have dreamed of to help them zero in on, and hopefully stop, misinformation campaigns before they get too far. Even social media giants that up till now have been pretty hands-off when it comes to policing content are starting to join in. Reddit, Google, Twitter, YouTube, even Facebook have all pledged to crack down on misinformation, all thanks to what we've seen happen during the coronavirus. It's raising the alarm of the kind of damage misinformation can do on a major scale. Kate Starbird hopes it can be a wake-up call for regular people, too.
I think there are things we can do to become less vulnerable, to be aware of how our political biases affect how we interpret information and choose what to share or not, to be aware more generally of where information is kind of manipulating us emotionally, and just be a little bit more reflective and more slow in how we share things is a way for us to become, you know, less vulnerable. And it's not just less vulnerable individually. This is a huge system where we're all sharing information together. And so we can become stronger collectively and make for a healthier information space by all just being a little bit more aware that we're all vulnerable and taking actions to address that vulnerability.
That story was reported by Liz Tong. Back in early March, when concerns and fears over coronavirus began to grow in the U.S. and lockdown orders were put into place, Malia Jones, a scientist at the University of Wisconsin, wrote an email to her family and friends about the outbreak.
Maybe I'm the closest thing you personally know to an infectious disease epidemiologist. Maybe not. I'm not an expert on this virus by any stretch. But I have general knowledge and training from studying epidemics that is applicable. So here are my thoughts. First and foremost.
And her friends and family said, that's amazing. Can you put that on Facebook? And she put it on Facebook and it went crazy viral pretty quickly.
That's Allison Buttenheim. She is a public health expert who studies the behavioral aspects of preventing infectious diseases, and she also started weighing in.
And one of our mutual friends said, hey, everybody, I'm just going to listen to these nerdy girls for the rest of the pandemic. They're going to be my source of info.
The nerdy girl's name stuck, and a couple more female public health researchers and clinicians got involved. They started Dear Pandemic. It's kind of like Dear Abby, questions and answers, but about coronavirus on different social media platforms. Allison says they answer questions like, is it safe to go back to the doctor? Can we do summer camp? How important is the, quote, voice that you use in your messaging? You know, I'm thinking public health messaging can sometimes sound like finger wagging. It can sound like it's reprimanding you, or sometimes a sense of humor really works. But it's a really careful balance. So how do you pick the voice when you are trying to communicate messages?
We do shoot for a pretty sort of light, funny voice. On the Instagram page, we talk in the third person. So we'll say, you know, those nerdy girls are telling you to, you know, wear your face coverings. And we know that's different from what we told you last week. One question we had on the Facebook page was, quick, and it's usually sort of a Q&A format. Should I try to catch a case of coronavirus to sort of get it over with? Because we'd been hearing about, you know, COVID parties. And our answer was just, hell no. big fat no on that one. I answered a question about did we overreact with our social distancing? And my answer was like, so much no, nobody no. just trying to keep people, this is something they're seeing in their Facebook feed. They haven't like gone somewhere to look for COVID information. And we hope that the light tone and the jokiness combined with, you know, hopefully our credibility and trust will just help people pay attention more.
I want to talk about the issue of trust and who the messenger is and who people believe. And I have a sense right now that people are trusting a lot of the messages that are coming out of the field of public health. But that's not always the case. And you certainly know that, given that usually you work a lot in vaccines.
I think that is such an important point here. And one of the things that we're trying to do with Dear Pandemic, but I also see, you know, city and state health departments trying to do, is really establish themselves as a trusted voice so that they can be the conduit for good information. And this has only been more complicated by how political, of course, this pandemic has become. So unfortunately, you know, the science is the science, but the filters and the outlets and the channels that it goes through to reach people can really do a number on it. And you're right, people don't know who to trust. It's just like when we hear information about, you know, whether coffee is good for us or butter is good for us or whatever all the nutritional research. We, because the science changes and we hear what sound like flip-flops coming from, you know, who we think are the experts, we have to sort of lay down that base of credibility so that people will even listen.
Allison says you can get a sense of who trusts what kind of information by just looking around outside.
And I just sort of do, of course, automatic surveillance when I walk around. I sort of look and see, you know, who's got face coverings on, who doesn't. And I think for a while, everyone sort of hopped on that bandwagon and made their beautiful homemade masks and, you know, rigged up clever things with dish towels and bandanas. When I'm outside now, I really don't see many people wearing them. Certainly not folks who are going running or bike riding or walking their dogs. I see more older people versus younger people wearing them. And then I see a lot of people with some kind of face covering around their neck, but it's not over their nose and mouth. So there's sort of a partial attempt, you know, sort of 50% credit for having one, but not wearing it properly. So I think there's just a lot of variation now, and we're getting some mixed messages, I think.
Based on the scientific evidence currently available, Allison and the other nerdy girls are wearing masks, and they strongly encourage others to do so as well. A lot of the questions they get on Dear Pandemic are based on stuff that people have seen on social media, like, should you wipe down all of your groceries?
You know, I saw that video of that guy in Michigan in his house wearing scrubs, you know, thoroughly wiping down every single item from the grocery shopping with a Clorox wipe. You know, do I need to do that? And we sort of dug in to the literature, and it seemed like, and, you know, we're sort of reluctant to tell people that they're overreacting on anything. You know, if when people were wearing masks early on, oh, they're overreacting, you know, we sort of don't want to say that because this is a dangerous disease, and we'd like people to do everything that they can to prevent it. But it just seemed like the effort that was going into that pretty, you know, hardcore, maniacal treatment of grocery items wasn't really worth it, again, epidemiologically. Like, you're much better off paying really strict attention to hand hygiene. And I know we're all sick of being told to wash our hands, but really, like, a lot of the bang for the buck in preventing this disease is the hand hygiene, not touching your face, and, you know, keeping high touch surfaces like your counters and your doorknobs clear. And it just didn't seem like we were going to advise people well in terms of, like, extra benefit that they'd be getting from Cloroxing all their cereal boxes. So that was one where we said, we know this guidance is out there and is getting a lot of play. We don't recommend that you're going to get a lot of advantage. You know, you can do it if you want, but don't do it at the expense of maintaining hand hygiene.
More recently, lots of questions have come in about safety risks associated with protests or marches against police violence. Allison says that has been tough to answer.
It's complicated, and that many things can be true simultaneously. So do mass gatherings increase transmission risk? Yes, they do. At the same time, we know a lot more about those risks than we did a month ago or 2 months ago. For example, we can say more about outdoors risk being less than indoors risk, and we can make guidance according to that new knowledge. And at the same time, structural racism is also a pandemic. It's longer and maybe slower, but also more violent than COVID-19. And at the same time, we can both worry about the protests increasing exposures and transmission, while we are also reluctant to tell Black communities and their allies that protesting is unacceptable. Both of those things can be true at the same time. Justice and equity and risk all take many forms. So it's complicated.
Allison Buttenheim is an associate professor of nursing and health policy at the University of Pennsylvania. You can find her and the other nerdy girls on different social media platforms at Dear Pandemic. Public health experts are giving advice on Facebook or Twitter as part of their jobs, or maybe they see it as a responsibility to weigh in. But during the coronavirus pandemic, some local governments have also paid influencers, like local celebrities, to spread public health messages. Is that a good idea? Reporter Alan Yu looked into that.
Big cities like Chicago, New Orleans, Boston, and Philadelphia worked with local celebrities, athletes, and influencers at the start of the pandemic to get people to stay home and wash their hands. People like musician PJ Morton.
This message right here is specifically for my city, New Orleans.
Zach LaVine from the Chicago Bulls and Eloy Jimenez from the Chicago White Sox.
Chicago, let's all do our part and stay home. We're not playing, and neither should you.
Do your part to slow the spread of COVID-19. You stay at home.
And speaker and entrepreneur Wallace Peoples.
You want to get updates on how Philadelphia is slowing down COVID-19? What I need you to do is, I need you to text COVID-PHF.
In Philadelphia, city council paid a total of $10,000 to local social media stars for their posts. It was less than a tenth of a larger COVID-19 advertising budget. Not everyone thought this was money well spent.
I just thought it was ridiculous that they would even accept money from the city to put out information that pretty much is saving all of our lives.
Journalist Ernest Owens wrote an opinion piece about this. He's a writer at large at Philadelphia Magazine. He has nothing against influencers. He knows it takes work to develop a following online. But he wants to know why the city is paying them for these messages to stay at home and social distance during the pandemic.
Where's the humanity and where is the ability to say, you know what, it doesn't cost me anything to make this post. It doesn't hurt to just help the city out and just help our society out by spreading this awareness.
He says there are people promoting local businesses, restaurants that have been hit hard, helping out with groceries, volunteering at food pantries without getting paid. So he questions why should Philadelphia, a city that has to consider cutting funds for housing and the arts, pay influencers for helping other people out? Other cities have faced this question too. Local government in Charlotte, North Carolina, proposed paying social media influencers as part of their COVID-19 outreach plan. The Charlotte Agenda, a local news site, reported that people erupted with jokes and questions about this idea. So many social media users and community leaders offered to spread COVID-19 prevention messages for free that the government eventually backed away from paying influencers. But to that, Danica Combo asks, why wouldn't you pay influencers? She's the CEO of Everywhere Agency, a marketing company based in Atlanta, Georgia, that connects businesses with influencers.
Do we complain if the city of Philadelphia pays for a billboard? Probably not. Do we complain if the city of Philadelphia paid to have posters printed? Probably not. Did they do ad buys on a website? Did we complain about that? Probably not. Influencers are just another communications vehicle.
She has worked with local governments and health organizations before on campaigns about vaccines and cancer. She says governments and healthcare providers should embrace influencer marketing.
How many conversations have you had recently about how to stay safe during quarantine or during the pandemic? And have you only gotten that message from your doctors? No, you've gotten that message from people you know. So why not arm influencers with the correct message about public health messages?
She says with public health campaigns especially, you want to spread a consistent and well thought out message. You want people to say very specific things.
You're asking for them to share it on their carefully curated channels. So again, that sounds more like a transaction than a favor to me.
So is it okay for public health messages to be transactions, to be more like marketing? Or is this so important for the greater good that people should do it without getting paid? Gynecologist Karen Tang spreads health information for free on social media.
Hi, I'm Dr. Karen Tang. I'm a gynecologist, and I joined TikTok basically to talk about periods, bad periods.
She is relatively new to this, but she already has a few thousand followers on Instagram and TikTok.
What if I told you there was a medical condition that affected up to 80% of people, could cause super bad pain, hemorrhaging, problems with fertility, and could grow the size of a watermelon in your abdomen? Well, there is such a condition. They're called uterine fibroids.
The way that I had been recently thinking about social media and its use with physicians and healthcare professionals was that social media is now kind of the frontier of public health messaging.
She uses her platform to talk about things like COVID-19, the health impact of systemic racism, and testicular cancer.
I have 3 kids, you know, working full time. I try and fit it in where I'm able to. It's almost become, my hobby.
She says doctors on social media are generally wary of getting paid for posts.
Most doctors active on these platforms are very aware of that and wanting to not dilute their message or make people kind of dubious of their message by making too many paid, hey, here's me, holding a brand of candy,
Working with influencers can be important when you're trying to reach specific groups with a message. Endocrinologist Sharita Golden has worked on public health campaigns with local celebrities in Baltimore, churches, and the NAACP. She says, for example, when you're trying to reach the African American community, who the message comes from, like a trusted figure or a local celebrity, can make a difference.
There is still not complete trust all the time.
There's a long history of racism and unequal treatment in medicine.
It's resulted in a mistrust between certain vulnerable communities and the healthcare system. And so that's why it's really important for healthcare systems to partner with those key members in the community who can sort of are seen as trusted members of the community.
But as to whether or not those trusted messengers should be paid, she is not sure.
I decided that when I became a physician, that I would use that platform to help really advance the messages for my community. People have sometimes tried to pay me. I don't accept payment for that. Each of us in life are given a platform. And then, you know, it's up to us to decide how we're going to use that platform.
That story was reported by Alan Yu. Like the doctors we just heard from in Alan's story, a lot of healthcare providers are really active on social media. Maybe you're friends with your primary care doctor on Facebook, or your dermatologist is super popular on Twitter. But not all that long ago, that was a big no-no.
It used to be that we would say, you know, it's really ill-advised to have a social media account and public presence, and you should avoid it. In fact, you should probably turn off your Facebook. You should probably not even be on it. You should turn off your Twitter.
That's medical ethicist Dominic Sisti. He says when social media started to become increasingly popular, med schools and hospitals were worried that their physicians would get in trouble in that space, cross boundaries, violate patient privacy. But now that advice has changed completely because Dominic says it's clear they have a role in providing information and communicating health issues. Connecticut gastroenterologist Earl Campbell embraces social media. He says it allows him to take charge of the narrative.
The big thing is you want to be the one that's driving what your social media presence is. And you know, a lot of different things that you may be involved in, those things are posted online. And by actually having your hands on the reins, whether it's Twitter, social media, Facebook, that can kind of dictate or drive what your presence is. So I wanted to have more of an active role in that. And then also as a minority physician, an African-American physician, I just wanted to be a source of inspiration, encouragement, mentor to other minorities that are looking to go into the field of medicine as well.
Earl used his Twitter account to spread a lot of information about coronavirus. During the first wave of infections, he did a rotation in the ICU and he documented what he saw and experienced.
Right now, even still, what I'm seeing in media, there's a lot of people you can even just see sometimes in comment sections, still don't really believe that coronavirus is a real thing. So I just feel that as we as physicians, as we're sharing our stories, showing what we're going through, you know, the fact that I'm for a period of time was out of my usual role and working in the ICU, the more I feel that we have these stories about the severity of what's going on there, the more, you know, you'll have believers that take this seriously.
Earl says his employer is supportive of his social media presence, but not all hospitals are. Medical ethicist Dominic Sisti says how doctors should express themselves on social media is still an open question for many employers, and sometimes lines are crossed. We've all seen, especially during this pandemic, we've seen really cute videos on TikTok or other places with a bunch of healthcare providers dancing or cheering, all of those things. What are some examples where that maybe has gone wrong?
There are examples where there are clinicians, I'm not sure if they're doctors or nurses or who they are, but they're literally making fun of patients, or they act out like the way a patient maybe behaves in a derogatory way. There's like one TikTok that I'm thinking about that is a sort of spoof on a patient who's claiming to have chronic pain but is drug seeking, right, as they would say. And it, you know, it's really, I think, degrading and offensive. There's other interesting examples where physicians are making kind of inside jokes that other physicians find humorous that are hard to really find funny unless you're a doctor. And I think those are some really interesting examples because it pushes us to wonder about the ethics of inside jokes that are public. So it could be the case that there are some jokes that are inside jokes that are really funny and offer some kind of therapy or therapeutic to doctors by allowing them to release frustration or angst or whatever it might be, distress. But folks outside of medicine don't really understand the joke. And so it could come across as offensive or as callous towards patients. And so that, I think it's important that doctors recognize that when they're using dark humor, which I think has an important role in medicine, actually, that if it's an inside kind of dark humor, making that public can have unintended consequences. It's not an inside joke anymore when you post it on a social media platform.
Dominic Sisti teaches medical ethics and health policy at the University of Pennsylvania. Coming up, researchers are mining our social media posts for information on our moods, like when we're happy.
There's a lot of laughter. Ha, 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 ha is a big word on Twitter. Four ha's strung together.
That's next on The Pulse.
Support for The Pulse comes from Select Greater Philadelphia. With over 30 cell and gene therapy development companies, Greater Philadelphia is where the field started and continues to thrive. More at discoverystartshere.com.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about social media and our health. The information we see on social media can impact health decisions we make, but it can also affect us in other ways, especially in terms of our mental health. Lots of people stay off social media for periods of time because what they see makes them too sad, too upset, or anxious. And sometimes it just gets really overwhelming. We bear witness to events that we need to know about, like police violence, but it can take a major emotional toll to see those images. Philando Castile bleeding to death after being shot by police, or George Floyd crying, "I can't breathe," while a police officer kneels on his neck.
That video gripped me, and it is yet to let me go.
That's psychiatrist Kareem Salam. He says watching this kind of violence, especially seeing it again and again, can be so traumatic it could lead to mental health issues like anxiety or depression.
Further adding to that, if you are like me and you share demographics with George Floyd, that could affect you on so many levels. When you view that video, you may envision yourself laying face down on that asphalt, watching the life evaporate and be forced out of your body. Of course, this could lead to re-experiencing of the traumatic event. It could lead to profound bouts of anxiety when you encounter law enforcement. Similar observations have been made among adolescents who are Latinx, who have watched footage of immigrant children being detained and being really kept in inhumane conditions. And these experiences have been similarly traumatic for Latinx adolescents. Also, on a different level, if you belong to one of those demographic groups, you may feel a sense of your own foreshortened future. And you could become overwhelmed with the notion of, could I be next? Could this be me? Could this be my sibling, my uncle, my nephew?
What are your recommendations in terms of interacting with those images and that kind of footage? It has a role, right? Because there is a profound power in witnessing those things. But then with all the detrimental impacts, how do we deal with that?
Mikan, I would strongly encourage folks to limit their exposure to the actual event. So let's use the Floyd event, the 8 minutes, 46 seconds. I only viewed that once. I caught snippets of it during subsequent news coverage, but just watching the thing in its entirety, I'm not sure how necessary that is going forward. It's so powerful. So one, I would urge limiting exposure. Two, you're watching this man lose his life, and one could become set upon with just profound helplessness. And so the cure for helplessness is action, even if that action is imperfect. I believe this event has really catalyzed a movement, and there's so many opportunities for folks to get involved. I had the blessing of participating in a protest in Mount Laurel Township in South Jersey that was organized by adolescents. And to witness these young people step into their power and realize that they are not merely victims, they can play a role in shaping history.
What about those who filmed this violence? You know, a lot of times, like in the case of George Floyd, the person who caught this on video is an adolescent herself.
The way I'd like to respond to that is that young lady is a hero.
Mm-hmm.
And she ought to be commended, because there's some adults who would freeze. There are many people who would just freeze, and literally they can't believe what's unfolding before them. So hats off to her for having the presence of mind to document this horrific crime. So Darnella Frazier, if you can hear me, you are a hero. You are an American hero. That said, you may not be exempt from suffering as a result, and trauma changes brains. There are biological underpinnings to that, and there are psychological underpinnings to that. And so it could have profoundly negative effects on a young person like this, especially if they feel that they are at higher risk for such events. It could absolutely have a profoundly negative effect on these young people and their ability to function socially, academically, emotionally, and the like.
Kareem Salam is an adolescent and child psychiatrist at Friends Hospital in Philadelphia. Researchers can detect and quantify our emotional reactions to tragic events like police shootings by mining our social media posts for specific words or expressions. The days of protests following the killing of George Floyd have seen the saddest days on Twitter to date. Chris Danforth does this kind of research.
Every day there are about 500 million messages, for example, posted to Twitter. And if you wrote them down on post-it notes, they'd wrap around the Earth's equator one time. We collect a random 10% of all those messages. And we have several instruments we've built to try and quantify aspects of our emotional state collectively and individually.
Chris is a professor in the Department of Mathematics and Statistics at the University of Vermont. He and his research team have built an instrument, the hedonometer, that tries to distill the emotions that are embedded in our posts. They've given happiness ratings to thousands of frequently used words in different languages. Words like sad or terrorist obviously score low on the happiness scale. Things like laughter score high.
On holidays, people talk about spending time with their family and loved ones and leisure activities. On the weekends, people talk about fun stuff they're doing. There's a lot of laughter. Ha, 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 ha is a big word on Twitter. Four ha's strung together. And then Tuesdays tend to be sad days when we look at all this together. People are at work usually and enjoying their lives a little bit less.
So what kind of words are they using on Tuesday?
I guess, you know, when you compare Tuesday to Saturday, people on Saturday use words more often like ha, 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 and weekend and movies and family and fun, there's also actually some negative words that are used more often on Saturday, like bored and drunk and tired. The sort of the mundane stuff that we go back to on our, on our work day, you wouldn't be surprised to see. But, you know, the sort of weekly cycle up and down is kind of what you'd expect that we get from this instrument. And then there are particularly happy days. U.S. holidays tend to be happy days. And then the sad deviations tend to be things like natural disasters or mass shootings or deaths of celebrities, things like that. Twitter is, is largely about music and politics and sports when there's nothing going on. And then there are these punctuated moments where there's something that grabs people's collective attention, and we see that in the emotion of their language.
The national conversation about police violence and racism has had an impact on the emotions expressed in people's posts. But before that, Chris already noticed a big change once the coronavirus pandemic really hit the United States.
What we've seen more recently is that, you know, the average sentiment of words, not just in English, but in other languages all over the world, has really exhibited a sustained sadness. So, you know, back in 2013, for example, the Boston Marathon bombing day was the saddest day that we had measured up until that point. And since early March, there was actually over a month of days consecutively that were sadder than that day was. And that, you know, that's unprecedented for the instrument that we've built.
Can you tell by looking at social media whether or not using social media is making people perhaps less happy during this pandemic because there's a lot of anxiety and this constant flow of information? Or is that, you know, is that too difficult to discern?
You know, this is a great question. And, you know, as a person who was on Twitter back in February watching the, you know, mathematical epidemiology colleagues of mine tear their hair out that the world wasn't paying attention, Twitter was an incredibly anxiety-producing place for me, because I'd leave it and go out into the world and see that people weren't talking about this virus as it's spreading out from China in the real world. They were talking about it on Twitter. And you know, that was my personal experience. But the research, we don't ourselves do this research on understanding its impact on us. But it seems to be the case largely with these studies that people are happier when they give up social media. It seems to be generally not good for us. And I expect that this pandemic will reveal that being on social media during this time, you know, increased people's anxiety.
That's Chris Danforth. He is a professor in the Department of Mathematics and Statistics and a member of the Computational Story Lab team at the University of Vermont. And finally, maybe a little look into the future of healthcare and social media. Could the kind of information we share online be used to detect health issues, to provide care, to get people into treatment? I mean, these posts are often really detailed logs of people's lives.
Things from what they're thinking the moment they wake up, all throughout the day, what they eat, what they're wearing, who they saw, how they're feeling.
This is emergency medicine physician Raina Merchant. She studies different aspects of health in online spaces. She says many people share a lot more about themselves on Facebook than they would be willing to disclose in a doctor's office. And she has learned that, for example, she can detect symptoms of depression by looking at posts.
And so the next step for that would be for consenting individuals, to understand more about providing early signals to people to say, gee, it looks like your posting has changed, or you're posting more at night, or you're posting more about a certain topic. Potentially that's something you might want to use for managing your own healthcare or to talk about with your provider.
This kind of work is just starting, and Raina says if you want to implement this kind of model, you have to move very carefully to make sure people feel empowered, that they understand who is monitoring their information and how it's being used. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, and Jed Slayman. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Xavier Lopez is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.